hppodcast.com.
Hello? Jules de Grandin seized the receiver from the office telephone before the echo of the tinkling bell had ceased.
Who is it, please? But of course, mademoiselle, you may speak with Dr. Trowbridge.
He passed the instrument to me and busied himself with a third unsuccessful attempt to ignite the evil-smelling French cigarette with which he insisted on fumigating the room. Yes, I queried, placing the receiver to my ear. This is Miss Ostrander, Dr. Trowbridge, a well-modulated voice informed me. Mrs. Evander's nurse, you know. Yes, I repeated a little sharply, annoyed at being called by an ordinary case after an onerous day. What is it?
I don't quite know, sir.
She laughed the short, semi-hysterical laugh of an embarrassed woman.
She's acting very queerly. She's... Oh, my, there it goes again, sir. Please come over right away. I'm afraid she's becoming delirious.
Oh, man. How many occult detectives are there?
Enough for a chess set, I think, maybe. Which I would be cool. One side occult detectives and one side monsters. Comes with a little pamphlet with the detective stories. Would you buy that? I might buy that.
I would actually buy that.
Fitz James O'Brien's character, Harry Escott, if you'll remember, appeared in the story What Was It? We covered that on episode 141.
I do remember that one, yeah.
Robert Bulwer Lytton's novella The House in the Brain has an occult detective. We talked all about that on episode 162, if you recall. Wow.
No, I don't.
Sheridan Le Fanu's Dr. Martin Hesselius appeared in the story Green Tea.
Yeah, that one I remember.
You remember that? Mm-hmm. 192 episode. And of course, there's Van Helsing and Dracula.
Don't remember that.
Well, you know what is weird? Van Helsing is a really popular first name right now for babies. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
It's like this year's Emily. It's crazy.
Wow. Okay.
And then there are the old standbys. Algernon Blackwood's Dr. John Silence, of course. Yeah. William Hope Hodgson's Carnacki, the Ghost Finder. And then Quiet and Bold.
Of course, yeah.
The gold standard. That's a lot of detectives, yet here we meet yet another, Jules de Grandin.
And those paragraphs that we heard just a moment ago were from the opening of Seabury Quinn's The Bloodflower, a werewolf story from Weird Tales that we're reading here on Strange Studies of Strange Stories. I am Chris Lackey.
And I'm Chad Pfeiffer. You're joining us on Patreon.
Who is that reader?
That was a cult performer, Andrew Lehman, on loan from the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society. Folks should know he's also co-host of the podcast Voluminous, which covers the letters of H.P. Lovecraft. We talked about some of those letters in the last 2 weeks when we were covering The Werewolf of Ponkard. So if you're interested in that kind of content, you liked that, much more intelligent hosts to tune into on Voluminous. Oh, yeah. Talking about that very thing. I called Andrew an occult performer. There is room for all professions within the occult industry. There's occult babysitters.
Occult bricklayers?
There's occult bricklayers. Anything you want.
Occult podiatrists?
Keep going with it. You will find. Wow. I'll confirm every single one of those professions.
Oh, okay, great.
In order to illustrate my kind of funny joke. By the way, we haven't even scratched the surface on these detectives, because when I looked those up, I saw that Sax Rohmer, the Fu Manchu author, has a collection that features the occult detective Morris Claw with a K.
Yeah.
Who utilizes Odic Force in his investigations.
Odic.
Great name. The occultist Dion Fortune made her contribution to the genre with The Secrets of Dr. Taverner, consisting of psychic adventures of the Holmes-like Taverner as narrated by his assistant, Dr. Rhodes. The funny thing is the author, Dion Fortune, that's a better occult detective name.
Yeah.
Aleister Crowley had a detective named Simon If, I-F-F, who was featured in a series of stories, some of which have been collected into a book. Dennis Wheatley had an occult detective, Niels Orson.
Wow.
Manly Wade Wellman, who we've covered a lot, but I don't think we've covered this character, John Thunstone. Have we?
No, I don't think so.
John Thunstone is an occult detective, looked in the pulps. Jack Mann, which is the pen name for E.C. Vivian, chronicled the adventure of his occult detective, Gregory Gordon George Green, known as Geez, G-E-E-S, in a series of novels.
Like the Bee Gees.
Like the Bee Gees, yeah. I think the Bee Gees, by the way, also occult detectives, and they want to know how deep is your love here on Podcraft 97.1. Robert E. Howard
You're still going. There's still more.
There's still more. Robert E. Howard created stories about Steve Harrison, an occult detective.
Yeah.
In the Strange Detective Stories magazine. I could tell you're really interested in this by asking
me. No, keep going.
Marjorie Lawrence created the character Miles Penoyer in her occult detective stories collected in number 7, Queer Street.
Wow.
Which is the most Tony-winning title I've ever heard. in my life, right? Number seven queer street is sweeping the West End. Other writers who have used the occult detective theme as a basis for supernatural adventures include Peter Saxon, the Guardian series, John Burke, who had Dr. Alex Caspian, Frank Loria, who has Dr. Owen Orient, which is the worst of these names. Lynn Carter had Anton Zarnak, and Joseph Payne Brennan had Lucius Leffing, which I like. The occult detective theme has also been used with series characters devised by contemporary writers such as Douglas Adams.
Oh, yeah, he did Dirk Gently.
Which is an occult detective, technically, so.
Yeah. And you forgot Ascot Keen from Dr. Satan, which we just covered.
Well, weirdly, that didn't get mentioned in this list from Wikipedia of occult detectives. So that's cold, weird. Ascot Keen!
Oh, man.
Back to your original question, how many occult detectives are there? A whole f***ing lot.
Yeah.
That's the answer. An impressive list. But Seabury Quinn is an author whom we haven't covered on the show yet, surprisingly. Looms very large in the pulps. I've been seeing that name in short story collections for as long as I can remember. It's such an interesting first name.
Yeah, never heard of him before.
As we mentioned on the first show of the month, he contributed the very first werewolf story to Weird Tales in 1923, which was called The Phantom Farmhouse. Apparently, this is a classic werewolf story involving a family of werewolves. The daughter falls in love with the main character, a clergyman, and seeks to be freed from her curse, even at the price of death. So that's some bonus homework to do on your own if you're enjoying Werewolf Month.
Yeah.
Go read that. But what do we know about this author?
Seabury Grandin Quinn was born in 1889 in Washington, D.C. He graduated law school in 1910 and served in the Army during World War I. And after the war, he became an editor for a group of trade papers in New York, but he also got into writing for the pulps. He was first published in the Motion Picture Magazine with the story The Law of the Movies in 1917, but Demons of the Night was published a year later in Detective Story magazine. This story has his occult detective Jules de Grandin, who was in other stories, his first in 1925. De Grandin even got his own novel called The Devil's Bride.
And Jules de Grandin at that time was read by Sandy Lehman, Andrew's great uncle. The Lehmans have been doing this character for a long time.
Good old Sandy.
It's an occult thespian family.
In 1937, Seabury went back to Washington and became a government lawyer for the duration of World War II. His first book was published in 1948 by Arkham House.
Nice.
It was called Rhodes and had something to do with Santa Claus and his pagan origins.
What? Awesome.
Arkham House also collected 10 of his de Grandin stories in a collection called The Phantom Fighter in 1966.
I was wondering how you would emphasize that, if it would be The Phantom Fighter or The Phantom Fighter.
Oh, yeah. Is he a guy who fights phantoms or is he a phantom that fights?
We'd have to go back and see how Sandy pronounced it, Sandy Lehman. He was still doing it in the 60s, still reading that character.
These de Grandin stories were popular at the time, but with hindsight, many folks think that they're not so great. Brian Stableford, in his book St. James Guide to Horror, thought of the de Grandin stories as indeed rather undistinguished, claiming that they are full of stereotyped characters and poorly resolved plots. Stableford states Quinn's best stories here are his ironically perverted love stories, such as The Globe of Memories and Glamour.
What does that mean, ironically perverted?
I'm not sure.
This perversion turned out other than expected.
Well, maybe it has to do with a posthumous book that got published. He died in 1969.
69, that's ironically perverted.
But this book that was published after he died was called Alien Flesh, and it's a sexually explicit erotic fantasy about a male Egyptologist who has a magical sex change into a beautiful young woman. It's been described as a bold and striking celebration of sexual confusion.
Who described it as that?
It was just on Wikipedia, but I thought on Goodreads, poster Nachtkind had this to say about it. Male Harvard graduate gets magically transferred into the body of sexy young harem maiden, full of over-the-top sexual and Eastern stereotypes. And then there's a little quote from the book here. I read one of Weininger's monographs that women regard clothes entirely differently from men, that they receive a sort of psychosexual stimulation when beholding lovely clothing. I remember thinking that statement was a lot of scientific bosh, but on that first day of my womanhood, I knew how right Herr Doctor had been. And Nachtkin wraps it up by saying, are you kidding me?
What does that mean? Are you kidding me? Surprised that this is something the author wrote or enraged by the premise or
the premise that women have a psychosexual stimulation from looking at nice clothing.
Mm-hmm.
And that once he became a woman, he too got a psychosexual stimulation from looking at clothing.
I think Noctkind accidentally grabbed a clip from an Ed Wood book, because if that freaks you out, get ready for that. I mean, my goodness. But you know what? That sounds pretty accurate. If the first person is this Harvard dude, you know, he would just become a woman and self-fulfill whatever dumb ideas he has. You know what I mean? True. Everything I thought about women is true because I'm still thinking it, right? That was it's kind of funny. But he didn't publish this. This is just something they found in the drawer, right?
Yeah, this is something that he had written but was not published.
Yeah, and it's 1977, so I actually think that as a writer, you had to write something like this in the 70s. Oh, that was the rule. I'm surprised it didn't get turned into like an 80s Zapped-style sex romp.
God.
That description, you know.
Woo, Zapped.
Kind of like this story is today.
Yeah, this story, The Blood Flower, was published in Weird Tales, March 1927. And you said you really liked this story?
Mm-hmm.
Is that true?
Let me be specific. I really didn't like the story, to tell you the truth.
Okay.
When I started it, I was mad because I just have had it with these psychic detectives. Is the exact reaction you had to that opening paragraph. But then it did something that's kind of rare. It got better. That just never happens. Like, I thought it was pretty cool at the end. And
okay.
Maybe you disagree with me, but we can talk about that then. I was also so tired at the end of the year, to be honest. Everything I read was great because I was reading instead of sitting at the computer. Let's see if I can defend my bold claims and jump into it.
The story begins with Jules de Grandin, a cult detective, hanging out with his buddy, Dr. Trowbridge. They get a call from a woman, a nurse, Miss Ostrander, who had been put in charge of watching over Miss Evander, a patient of Dr. Trowbridge. She calls and tells them to come over quickly. De Grandin is annoyed that they have to go out in the snow that evening.
We set up here this little joke that de Grandin has problems with English idioms. I think it appears a few times in the story. You know, he says to the nurse, why did you call me? You have my sheep. What do you say? You know, my goat? He gets it wrong first. You've got my sheep. Yeah.
When they arrive, the door is answered by the butler, who is frightened. And Miss Ostrander explains that she heard howling outside and that Miss Evander got troubled in her sleep. When Nurse Ostrander checked on her, she growled at the nurse like an animal. The nurse backed off and the howl came again, closer this time. And Miss Evander howled back in the same tone to the dog/wolf. The doc and de Grandin seem skeptical, but when they hear the howl themselves and then Miss Evander howls back, they are on board.
Without sound design, dramatizing the scene would just be so funny. You couldn't make it scary, really, you know.
No.
I mean, if it was actually happening in your life,
sure,
it would be terrifying.
Oh my God, yeah.
But watching it is hilarious. I don't know.
It's funny. When they go to check on her, they catch her trying to go out the window. They are able to grab her before she goes, and they pull her back into the bed. She's fighting them hard and snarling, scratching and biting.
Yeah, you ever see The Howling 2? Your sister is a werewolf. Did you?
What?
There is a sequel to The Howling that is called Your Sister is a Werewolf.
What?
I thought maybe that would have been something.
What was the one with Sybil Danning? Was that
that's
that
it.
One?
That's
oh,
the one.
Oh, yeah, I did see it, yeah. Isn't it? Wait, Christopher Lee's in it, too, isn't
Christopher
he?
Christopher Lee's in it, and he was so embarrassed by the movie that you can tell he didn't want to be anywhere near the set. You know, they're always shooting him. That was when you didn't have very many choices. The Howling 2 was at the video store, you know, in the horror aisle, so eventually you were going to watch it. It's a terrible movie, although a lot of it's really funny because it is werewolves biting and snarling, and they don't really have the budget to make it cool, so it's just people in that makeup like looking at each other and going so it's unintentionally hilarious, but it's just so offensively exploitative of Sybil Danning. It's a terrible movie, but for some reason it bubbled up in my brain as I was reading.
Wow, Sybil Danning, she's 74 years old now.
Sybil, yeah, that's awesome.
Now back to business. De Grandin tells Trowbridge to give her some morphine and knock her out, which he does. They ask where Mr. Niles Evander is, and the nurse says that he's out of town on business. De Grandin has some strong feelings about business.
With you Americans, it's always the business. Business before pleasure, business before happiness, called you business before the safety of those you loved.
There's probably some truth to that. Certainly it's a stereotype about Americans from that time. I don't know if that holds now, but this seems more like it's backward stereotyping on him because he's French and therefore lazy. You know,
right?
You Americans, it's always don't cheat on your spouses, don't eat chocolate in bed all day. It's always take a shower, don't stink, mon dieu. You know.
Yeah. Oh, so Mr. Evander is to be back tomorrow, and Trowbridge tells the nurse to give her some drugs before bed.
Now, I have taken issue with most of the methods of our other supernatural detectives.
Yeah.
And I, too, was kind of against this character to begin with. But doping her up until he can figure things out, I thought was a pretty solid strategy.
Yeah.
A lot of times, it's when the detective goes off to do research that bad things happen. Mm-hmm. And he's just freezing the circumstances until he can figure it out, which, or do whatever he's going to do, which I thought was cool, actually.
Yeah. But unfortunately, the next night, they're back in their shared house of DeGrandon and Trowbridge. Do they live together?
I think it's just kind of crib in the Holmes-Watson, because they live together in Baker Street, too.
Yeah, because it's actually Trowbridge that is the narrator of this story.
Exactly. He's the Watson.
Like Watson, yeah.
Yeah.
Niles, the husband, shows up to their house, and he's pissed off. He's saying, I come back home, and my wife is all doped up. I ain't having that. Who do you think you are doing that to my wife? I only listen to American doctors. Isn't Trowbridge an American?
I think he's British because I didn't grow up around a lot of Trowbridges.
Okay.
And it also sounds absolutely like a British name an American would come up with.
Right.
Yeah, it's like Sexton or, you know, just something that sounds like a profession. That's what makes him British, I guess.
Yeah, I was talking to some of my English friends about how Wesley is this name that Americans think people name their children in England, but nobody here is actually named Wesley.
Oh, really? Yeah, I can see that. Why is that?
Beats me.
Was that the guy's name on Mr. Belvedere? No, that was the American kid's name on
the American
kid's
name.
Well, I think it might come from Mr. Belvedere.
Yeah, well, Wesley, you know, in Princess Bride, and Wesley Snipes in 30 Rock.
It's Wesley Snipes. That's what it is.
Played by Michael Sheen.
Yep.
He also says he made sure that she's not taking any more drugs. Not at his house. And DeGrandon face palms the situation.
You Americans never wanting to take medication for anything.
Just as this guy is talking about how clever he is for not giving his wife drugs, they get a phone call from the nurse, and it seems Miss Evander has escaped the house. Niles is shocked, and they all go back.
When they get there, sure enough, she's gone.
DeGrandon asks the nurse if she heard the howling again, and she confirms that she did. She could see that Miss Evander was going to try and escape.
She was savage as a maniac.
She went to go get the butler for help, but when she returned, Mrs. Evander was gone. They went outside looking for her, but the snowstorm was so bad they couldn't find any tracks. Niles wants to call the police, but DeGrandon says not to. Why not? Asks Niles, and DeGrandon asks him what he does for a living. And he says he's an engineer. Then DeGrandon says,
precisely, exactly. Dr. Trowbridge and I are medical men. We do not attempt to build bridges or sink tunnels. We should make very sorry work of it. You, monsieur, have already once tried your hand at medicine by forbidding the administration of a drug we considered necessary. Your results were most deplorable. Kindly permit us to follow our profession in our own way. The thing we most of all do not desire in this case is the police force. Later, perhaps. Now it would be more than ruinous.
So again, we find that DeGrandon has messed up an American idiom, you know, to wit, I don't come to your job and so don't tell me how to do mine.
DeGrandon says we'll go out and look for her. She'll be fine either way, he promises. Niles is like, she's out in a snowstorm, only in her nightie. She will die.
I've studied in enough medicine and seen enough nighties to know that.
DeGrandon assures him that she won't and she will return home.
He says, I don't make mistakes. So I had a really strong dislike of the character.
Yeah.
I was liking the story because I knew there was a werewolf in it. I wanted him to get eaten by that werewolf. Yeah. That's what was going on at this point.
He's real cocky.
I admit.
The doc and DeGrandon leave and they get into his car. DeGrandon says, let's go home. And the doc is like, wait, I thought we were going to go look for her. And he goes, no, we're not going to do that. She'll be fine wherever she is. She'll return home in the morning. She won't freeze because she's going to have a nice fur coat.
You know, he lets it go there. I guess we'll find out more later. If somebody did that to me, I actually wouldn't be friends with them anymore. I've probably said this before, but it's like, I just don't believe it. If I were in a position, barring physical restraint, I would just keep asking like a toddler, what do you mean? What does the fur coat mean? Explain that to me. If I were in a psychic detective story, it would take a weird left turn here. And DeGrandon would just be trying to win back my friendship for the rest of the story.
So the next morning, they get a call from the nurse. Mrs. Evander has returned, and they go to the house. The nurse explains that she found Miss Evander lying on the wolfskin rug in front of the fireplace, naked, with her clothes in a pile next to her.
You mean she was, how do you say, salty, sugary, spicy. This is what you Americans call it. You could see everything, no?
The nurse got Mrs. Evander to bed. The nurse also tells them that she had what looks like dried blood under her fingernails. And DeGrandon wants any samples of this blood that she may have from a washcloth, and she hands it over.
Back at the office, he tests the blood, and it's dog blood. And DeGrandon you know, he was afraid it might have been human blood, so he's happy to see that it's only dog blood. He knows what the rules are here. Yeah. He's got a plan. He needs to prepare. He says, we'll get together again tonight and prepare to be amazed. I shall be surprised if I do not astonish myself. What an egomaniac. That not only he's going to astonish himself, and if he's not, it's going to be astonishing. So everything he does, and no matter what happens, is going to be amazing and astonishing. Wow. He's kind of a proto-Clouseau, Inspector Clouseau, since we're doing French detective stereotypes.
That night, they all sit up with Miss Evander. We find out that she had a great day and was better than she had been in a while. They knock her out anyway, and eventually they hear the howl, and it's close. They hear it again, and it's right outside the window. De Grandin sees it coming up the lattice to the window, and the ghastly form creeps into the room.
Not human, nor yet wholly bestial it was, but partook grotesquely of both, so that it was at once a foul caricature of each. The forehead was low and narrow, and sloped back to a thatch of short, nondescript colored hair resembling an animal's fur. The nose was elongated out of all semblance to a human feature, and resembled the pointed snout of some animal of the canine tribe, except that it curved sharply downward at the tip, like the beak of some unclean bird of prey. Thin, cruel lips were drawn sneeringly back from a double row of tusk-like teeth which gleamed horridly in the dim reflection of the open fire, and a pair of round, baleful eyes, green as the luminance from a rotting carcass in a midnight swamp, glared at us across the windowsill. On each of us in turn, the basilisk glance dwelt momentarily, then fastened itself on the sleeping sick woman like a falcon's talons on a dove.
Hey, I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, I was a little distracted by the illustration that was in the story in Weird Tales, because I was reading it from... there's a website that has PDFs of the old Weird Tales. And he looks like a weird, skinny witch creature. Like, the way that they drew him, his nose, the description, hearing that, it makes it sound like it said pointed snout of some animal of the canine tribe. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that, yeah, that jives with my idea of what a werewolf is. But then it says, except that it curved sharply downward at the tip like the beak of some unclean bird of prey. And the drawing is like a witchy nose. Like, it actually, just the nose goes really far out. And then at the end of it, it just goes down.
Yeah, when we post about this show coming out, I will have used that for the social media post. So you can go there and look at the illustration. It's also linked out to the actual Weird Tales issue if you want to check it out there. I had the same sensation where I thought, this doesn't look like a werewolf at all.
No.
This looks like one of the statues on Easter Island or something. But I couldn't stop looking at it. It was just a weird illustration.
It is.
So in that respect, it was successful. But a werewolf, I don't know.
Now, before the thinking grabber, De Grandin pulls out a switch and he starts beating the beast. And it freaks out and jumps out the window. De Grandin jumps out the window and chases it, yelling at it in French and English. Then he pulls out a gun and he shoots the creature 8 times and it drops dead.
That was awesome.
That was good.
Because this is a psychic detective, I figured he'd have some magic mumbo-jumbo, be very passive like these other guys, you know, and just knows everything.
No.
But this Frenchman went on the attack, and he pulled a move, which I've actually in real life seen win fights, which is he started the fight before the other person. Like, there's that moment in a fight where the other guy's posing, and most of the time, whoever starts first wins, you know?
Yeah.
Because if you get the jump on somebody, what can they do? And he does that here. He jumps up and he beats the werewolf with the switch. Well, the werewolf's still busy being scary.
Yeah.
And the werewolf, it says, is surprised.
Yeah.
It's like, what the?
Now, the dead werewolf turns back into a human, an old man. Niles comes out and checks on it and says that is his wife's uncle, Friedrich. De Grandin is using the branches of an ash tree. That was what he's whipping him with, mm-hmm. which is a vulnerability for werewolves and vampires, too, I guess.
Which I originally learned in my book, Meet the Werewolf, which I mentioned in our very first Werewolf month. So maybe the reason I like this so much is it started connecting to the information that was in there that I learned when I was younger. Mm-hmm. Like later there's a recipe and that kind of thing was exactly what was in Meet the Werewolf.
Yeah.
And it made me feel like, yep, I am prepared for this menace if it ever if it ever happens. I have the right source book. Also, Uncle Friedrich was never seen in this story, right?
No.
So this is only a revelation to Niles. That may be a flaw in the story. I would have liked it if this guy had showed up, so it was a little bit more of a surprise for me.
Sure.
Niles explains that he wasn't really her uncle, but a friend of the family. The guy was always a bit of a creep and would stay with them on occasions when traveling. Niles really didn't like the way this guy leered over his wife. Does she have a name? A first name, by the way?
You know, they did mostly address her as Mrs. Evander, but I did find a paragraph where they used her first name, and it was Van Helsing, I think. So, it was popular then, too. No, I think he said it was Edith.
All right. Now, he disappeared a few days before Niles left for business. He would often go off on these trips without telling anybody, so Niles really didn't think much of it. De Grandin asked Niles to tell him everything about this dude. And he says that Friedrich did travel to Transylvania, and he has recently gotten some weird flower from there. De Grandin is able to identify it as the blood flower. Niles says that Friedrich made some weird-smelling stuff from it and gave it to his wife as some kind of perfume. Friedrich wore it in his lapel, the flower. Mm-hmm. Niles didn't want to be anywhere near it because he didn't like the way it smelled. Good thing, says De Grandin, because it would have turned you into a beast as well.
That's pretty cool, this flower mythology. One thing I really liked about reading about werewolves in that book and other books when I was a kid was that it was kind of non-standard. It varied a lot more than vampire myths. And it was,
sure.
Sometimes it was genetic, sometimes it was a bite, sometimes a curse, a scratch, sometimes a satanic pact, sometimes a flower, that came up a lot, or things like accidentally drinking water out of a werewolf's footprint.
Yes.
I liked all of that mythological weirdness that came with the werewolf.
We get some of that in this story right here, this part. He talks about in France, they're called the Les Loups Garous. Wales, they're bug wolves or boogie wolves. In Greece, they're the Lycanthropes.
Is it bogey wolves? You said boogie wolves. I think
that's a
bowling team in Scranton.
And then he runs through some causes that you mentioned, and he says that there was also a drunk guy in the neighborhood who saw Friedrich as a werewolf, but he thought he was just seeing things, so he swore off the booze.
Yes! That's a little of that B-movie moment
is.
I love, of the drunk throwing the booze bottle away after seeing the premise. One of my favorites.
Yeah, so good thing that this werewolf case is all over, right?
Yeah.
Wrong! Seems Mrs. Evander is still a werewolf. Niles cries and begs De Grandin to do something, and he offers him $10,000. In the 20s, that's a lot of money.
Yeah.
If he could save her. And De Grandin twirls his blonde waxed mustache and says, okay. And I'm thinking, oh, so he's a mercenary. That's kind of interesting that he's motivated by money, because these guys never are. They're always independently wealthy.
Yeah.
And it's just about the case. I'm like, okay, that's cool. So he gets together his kit, some bits from an ash tree to make some bindings. Ash tree rope, I guess. And then we actually get a recipe in the story. 3 pints of pure spring water, some sulfur, some opium, some castoreum, a few other things.
Ammonia, gum camphor. We were complaining so much about the non-specificity of these other psychic detective stories. This thing's got a recipe.
Yeah.
It's got a diagram in the text. It's a real plan of attack.
And the drawing is the circle, which is, like you said, actually in the book or in the published story. There's an illustration for it. He says it's a pentagram, but the drawing is actually a hexagram. It's got 6 points.
Yeah.
De Grandin is totally full of crap. And they're doing this whole thing at the Evander home, this whole ritual.
It's a translation error, as usual.
Sure. He gets this piping hot concoction. When Mrs. Evander starts to change, they grab her, and Tobridge uses the ash ropes to bind her. They pick her up and put her into the circle. She's struggling, but not escaping. De Grandin tells all non-essentials, get out of the house. And he says some prayers. He takes the boiling concoction and he pours it down Mrs. Evander's throat.
God,
that's brutal. Then some dark shadows form in the corners of the room. Then they collect over the circle and then they disappear. And then Edith is fine.
Except for her esophagus, which has been destroyed. It's like she won't be howling anymore or eating or speaking. That'll be $10,000.
Now, a little time passes, and Niles Evander is pleased, and he says he's going to pay De Grandin the money. But no, De Grandin doesn't want the money. I was messing with you. Ho, ho, ho. Seeing your lovely wife return is reward enough for me. Boo!
Boiling your wife's esophagus, reward enough for a humble man like me.
So he's not a mercenary. He was just trying to teach that guy a lesson, I guess.
Yeah, it's the A-team.
We have a wrap-up scene with De Grandin and Trowbridge. Trowbridge asks about the silver bullet thing, and De Grandin says, ah, it's all bunk. With our modern weapons, we could totally kill werewolves.
I like that.
Yeah, they got machine guns and stuff now, so why not?
Mm-hmm.
Trowbridge then asks, what are we going to do about the police? And this is something I thought about immediately when it happened to the story, when they killed her uncle. That's his body's there. De Grandin just shot a dude eight times in the back. You know, that's what the police would see. So he goes, oh, don't worry about it. God, I've taken care of it.
I myself did dispose of him this very afternoon. He lies buried beneath the roots of an ash tree, with a stake of ash through his heart to hold him to the earth. His sinful body will rise again, no more to plague us, I do assure you. He was known to have a habit of disappearing. Very good. This time there will be no reappearance. We are through, finished, done with him for good. We drove another mile or so in silence. Then my companion nudged me sharply in the ribs. This curing of werewolf ladies, my friend, he confided, it is dry work. Are you sure there is a full bottle of brandy in the cellar?
And that's the end.
I wonder if Trowbridge was like, look, it's not that I'm worried that he's going to come back. It's you being arrested for murder when they find that buried body. Since you shot him out in the open. No, no, let's go down to the cellar, Trowbridge. Keep talking. I think he killed Trowbridge after that. That's the implication. You're the only one that knows this.
I like that ending better.
I don't know. I enjoyed the story. I thought it got better.
Yeah, it's got interesting bits in there, and it moves at a pretty good clip. I'm just kind of tired of these psychic detective guys. They're really,
I understand that.
They're really wearing on me.
I intuited that about you.
But I am not weary of the reading of Andrew Lehman.
Oh my gosh, he's so great.
He took this sow's ear and made it into a silk purse.
It's a family tradition for him. Old Sandy Lehman used to do it. Now yep. He's passed on the torch. Sandy's short for Sandrew. I didn't know that was a name back then either. You know who else I want to thank? Some of our patrons. I'm going to start by thanking MiceMan391.
Aww, I'd like to thank Denzil.
I'd like to thank J.D. Shaw.
Darren Wood, thank you so much.
Justin Kolodzij, thank you.
Nils Onlin, thank you.
Khalil, thank you.
I'd like to thank Joe Collins.
Ian Fabry, thank you so much.
And lastly, Stacy Taylor, thank you so much for your support.
We're back next week with one more of these stories. It's The Wolf Woman. It's again from Weird Tales. And this has got a very, like, Mountains of Madness vibe to it.
Oh,
it's
whoa.
An Antarctic,
really
prehistoric kind of,
okay.
Shouldn't have defrosted that
oh,
kind of story.
Okay,
so
yeah.
I promise it's that you're gonna like it more than this one. I
promise. Okay, great.
And you know I keep all of my promises. That's all we have for this week. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to Strange Studies of Strange Stories
here on Patreon.